Well, hi, this is Dave, and welcome to our final seminar in this series. I'm eager to hear from each of you what you've really taken away and what's been most important to you in this series. And secondly, has this met the expectations of what you hoped you take away. I would welcome hearing from any of you about where you are now in this process. Anyone? We're going to be talking about extreme success challenges in our final seminar. This is something that I think we may not pay enough attention to as coaches, but I think especially as you get more and more successful as coaches, this is something you'll have to deal with yourself, and especially in working with clients who have exceptional success, to help them really regulate and balance, to stay attuned to their values, their needs, and to incorporate success and stay with it. It's a different kind of challenge to get to the top of the mountain than it is to stay at the top of the mountain. There's some things that I've come to see and some research that's been done a little bit that I've participated in that I want to share with you. But I want to get any responses, questions. If you'd manage the background noise, I'm hearing some background. I'll mute, but I'd like to hear any discussion or questions first. Thanks. Anything you'd like to discuss from any of the first three sessions or where you are with this material? Okay, I'm going to put us on lecture mode and move into the discussion, and then we'll have some time at the end for questions and anything you'd like to talk about. Let's first talk about exceptional achievement and overconfidence. If you ask any player in a physician's basketball league whether he or she could compete with LeBron James, they would laugh. Yet many of those same physicians willingly compete with billionaire investor Warren Buffett. Cognitive biases and mental errors make them believe they can outperform successful full-time investment experts. Those who have achieved in exceptional ways create challenges for themselves, sometimes just in the very attainment of that success. Some very highly successful individuals, from expert actors and athletes to practicing medical and legal and other professional experts, began to believe that they can be good in other areas. Investing is an example. But expertise in one area does not equate with expertise in another. Even Warren Buffett recognized this about himself. He said, "I don't think being able to allocate capital means you're good at anything else." Overconfidence creates a misperception of ability when it's informed by spectacular success in one area. University of Pennsylvania psychologists Philip Tetlock and Barbara Mellers studied over 25,000 forecasts from people whose task it was to anticipate how the future would unfold. Their studies, like a number of others, have revealed exceptional overconfidence in the judgment of doctors, lawyers, engineers, and even scientists in their decision-making process. The stimulation of overconfidence is biologically habituating. Look at the recent revelations of politicians, actors, and athletes who came to believe their success made them immune to boundary violations. From Macbeth, we learn that we are most vulnerable not when we are beginning, not even when we're destitute or needy, but after the biggest triumphs of our lives. For Macbeth, the moment the witches came was after the most massive successes he had ever experienced, of winning two battles and enjoying immense popularity. Just look at Elvis, Marilyn, Janice, F. Scott, Kurt, Belushi, Philip Seymour. Some people need mentor coaches not to become successful, but to help them regulate their states of mind, to manage emotions, to sustain success. Complacency and overconfidence become equal challenges. Navigating extreme success creates unique challenges. Exceptional success transcends all usual and expectable categories, such as the athlete who plays well or defies the limits of physical aging. It also occurs when accomplishments or the resultant fame or wealth from those accomplishments transcend any possible anticipation, preparation, or even model of engaging. In fact, Keith Richards put it most simply, fame has killed more very talented guys than drugs. Let's look at a phenomenon that I think that you will see and experience in some ways in many of your clients. Success anticlimax. This is a phenomenon that's so common, yet it's often surprising because it's hard to anticipate or prepare for. For example, after Bruce Jenner's last decathlon in Montreal, the next morning he asked, "What am I going to do now?" Success anticlimax occurs after the completion of a long-practiced and anticipated event. The excitement, preparation, anticipation are mediated by dopamine, the pleasure chemical released by anticipatory excitement. This sprint system of dopamine shifts when the event is over, when the marathon neurochemical system of norepinephrine, designed to maintain and sustain efforts, takes over. It's simply experienced differently. It's not as exciting anymore. This shift can read as a lack of excitement, as if something were missing, which of course it is in a way because of, compared to the anticipatory stimulation of dopamine, anything other than that is going to feel way less exciting, even to feel slightly depressed. Robert Louis Stevenson said this very simply, to travel hopefully may be a better thing than to arrive. The athletes and executives I've worked with and others I've interviewed have learned to contend with the anticlimax of shifting from stimulating anticipation to sustaining maintenance and as well to dose anticipation in an effective way. Let me give you another very simple example. I vividly recall my favorite athletic coach's first introduction to me of his version of this aspect of sports psychology. As a freshman, I was fortunate to make the varsity traveling squad of 12 players in basketball, even though I felt intimidated by the upperclassmen surrounding me most of the time. Well, all the time, actually. Just after we won our first tournament and boarded our bus, Coach stood at the front of the bus and looked at each of us. We were all feeling pretty good at the big win, eager to get home and celebrate with the parade downtown. He said, "So we won this tournament. This is not the biggest or the most prestigious tournament that we'll play. It's kind of a podunk tournament." And then he paused. "How many of you can really say you're proud to win this tournament?" Well, under any circumstances, I would have raised my hand, and I suspected my teammates would, but no one dared venture a single finger in the air. He finally concluded, "Feel good for now, but let's get home and really start working on being an excellent team." Coach knew how to handle success anticlimax to ladder success. His life-changing coaching and mentoring of me for 4 years in three sports resulted in many wins, some championships, but most importantly, my two sequential careers of helping others succeed. For any physical or intellectual achievement, the emotional and creative closure have to be addressed upon a successful completion. I've known authors, for example, who describe a letdown after completion of their book. One even described it as a postpartum depression, and that was a guy. The most successful achievers have evolved their strategies to ladder success and planned for transitions. So let's look at another aspect now. Does proven evidence change beliefs? We usually try to give information to convince someone of something. Facts and beliefs are anatomical realities in our brains. You don't create change by suddenly introducing a new idea or belief and expect it to override the one that's already there, though. Many of you have heard me say, if information was enough, we'd all exercise every day, eat mostly vegetables, be thin, and have a lot of money for the saved up for the future, and a lot of librarians would be billionaires. Facts and logic are not powerful tools to alter opinions. Data is not a way to change minds. It's simply not how we decide. Established beliefs are extremely resistant to change, even when scientific evidence disproves those beliefs. In fact, proven evidence can actually backfire. Here's how. People regard information as valid evidence when it reinforces their existing views. Presenting someone with information that contradicts an opinion that they hold most often results in that person generating new counterarguments to further strengthen their view. Now, those of you with adolescent children need no further explanation of this principle. This is called the boomerang effect. In fact, I have a blog that I posted a couple of days ago on the boomerang effect that's under the blog tab on my website for a little bit further information on this. And you can sign up for the blog and not ever have to search it out again. This is how arguments more staunchly solidify an original position. As a result, people grow more confident in their initial convictions and use information to polarize opinions. Common examples: abortion, gun control, climate change. We quickly accept evidence that confirms our preconceived notions, and we assess counter evidence with a critical, even disbelieving eye. We then cherry-pick information to fortify our beliefs, perhaps without even being consciously aware of it. In fact, recent studies have shown that the more intelligent people are, the greater their ability to creatively rationalize and interpret information to fit their opinions. They use their intelligence not to examine data or to draw more accurate conclusions, but to find fault in data that they already disbelieve. The mind's desire for continuity and certainty, coupled with activating the brain's error detection mechanism with new or unexpected information, both contribute to the continuity of belief and action. Let's consider now briefly success traps in business. A success trap in business is an almost ubiquitous developmental phenomenon in which a company must shift and evolve the way it operates in order to survive. One example, Kodak stuck to analog photography, did not evolve to digital. The canal boat companies of the 1700s didn't become the railroad companies of the 1800s. They stuck to their box. And in the 1900s, there were no Union Pacific Airlines. They stuck to their box. Good to gone. More recently, Andy Grove at Intel described the success trap as being a time in an organization's life when the leaders have to think differently from only developing and refining what's already successfully in place to think creatively of what can be. Grove said, miss the moment and you start to decline. He noted the difficulty at Intel to move on from the very successful memory chips to embrace the next technology of microprocessing in order to sustain the future viability of an entire company. We face that every day when it's easier to continue with a successful model of something that we do that works to not look at what may be or what we may be missing. Successful performance for an individual or company can sustain focus on what created the success rather than looking for the next success. The new success becomes the old success unless you have a new model to step into. Attention to execution of the current success may miss the innovation needed to take the new steps forward. This is actually deliberate practice applied to the system of a team or a business. Here's another kind of an example. Brain scans of 63 seasoned business decision makers showed two things. Moving to new territory of exploratory strategies disengages from the pleasing routine of certainty. To leave the default mode to attend to new possibilities is uncomfortable. It takes more energy. Yet at the same time, creative innovation stimulates the brain circuitry of anticipation and reward. Let's look at some performance-related biases and their remedies. And I want to review these so that you'll have your radar coded for listening to these when you hear them with your clients so that you can quickly, collaboratively look together at them. There are some specific biases that are often created or exaggerated by success that do have a unique impact on performance. Awareness of the tendency of these biases to psychologically influence decisions and actually dilute optimum performance, I think, becomes important to recognize. Here are some of the most common performance-related biases and their remedies. Self-deception. These self-deceptions have been distilled from a number of studies. One is self-inflation, especially at times of significant success. Some examples. 94% of people place themselves at the top half of their profession. 70% of both men and women feel they're better looking than average. 19% of people believe they're in the top 1% of income. 70% of drivers believe they're better than average. I mean, I know here in Houston, that's definitely not true. 75% of people consider themselves healthier than average. Another, denigration of others. The shadow story of self-inflation occurs when an image has been tarnished or when there's a need to align with an in-group and degrade the outgoing, or even to align with the powerful, such as in Stockholm Syndrome, the identification with the aggressor. Another example, moral superiority. Naturally, the referees are right when they call a foul on the visiting team, but their worst mistake is calling a foul on my favorite Houston Rocket. If I ever moved to Dallas, it would instantly become my favorite Maverick, and the Rockets would be out of favor. Another, the illusion of control. When we feel a lack of control, it enhances our tendency to see meaningful patterns in otherwise random data. It gives us a false sense of effectiveness. The brain is a pattern-seeking organ, and sometimes we superimpose that to overread something. Maybe conspiracy theories would be an example. Another, invincibility bias. Here are some common examples of invincibility bias. Adolescents, their job description is to have an invincibility bias. They tend to estimate danger poorly, to exaggerate anticipated performance, and risky behavior results. Heavy smokers underestimate their cancer risk despite objective awareness of danger. Skiers ignore warning signs and enter restricted areas to ski dangerous terrain, sometimes to their peril. Someone sees a roulette wheel stop on red 6 times in a row and believes that the chances are higher than 50-50 that it's going to stop on black the next spin. 6 times in a row, law of averages, 100% of those who believe the roulette wheel has a memory and will abandon the 50-50 red-black probability is wrong. Although some, probably half, will win their next bet and be right for the wrong reason. Another, optimism bias. An optimism bias is our tendency to underestimate the possibility of bad events in our lives and to overestimate the possibility of good events. We underestimate, for example, the likelihood of a car accident, of having cancer, and overestimate our life expectancy and future income. Newlyweds estimate the likelihood of divorce at 0%, while statistically over 40% will end in divorce. Hindsight bias. Knowing how things turned out already can influence the way we both remember and even reframe past events to make an outcome seem inevitable. Nassim Taleb studied this extensively in his book, The Black Swan Effect. Subjectivity bias. We have an ability to spot thinking and systematic errors in others, yet may at times struggle to look objectively to assess our own. We can spot biases way more readily in our friends than ourselves, simply because we are observers of them and cannot as easily bring into objective focus our own process of thinking and behaving. This is part of what we do in mentor coaching, is to help someone develop a greater capacity to not just be empathic with themselves, but to be observers of themselves, to self-regulate, and to develop that internal compass as they evolve a new story. Present bias. We put great value in the present, so much so that it may take a massive future reward to forego the impulse and the pleasure of the present in order to invest in the future. People jeopardize their future for current pleasure, whether it's indulging in unhealthy snacks, procrastinating on exercise, or spending now in lieu of saving for the future. For example, people with a present bias invest less in their retirement accounts as well as in their future health. The future is both a theory and an abstraction, so it actually competes poorly with the immediate reward of the pleasure chemical of dopamine. Another, transparency bias. When we perceive fairness, we experience a rewarding good feeling. When we perceive unfairness, this triggers the reptilian brain that mediates the perception of threat and survival with its own neurochemical system. Fairness, a keystone in both collaboration and leadership, can be overwritten by the sense of unfairness to interfere with creativity, motivation, and teamwork. A big factor in the perception of fairness is transparency. The effort we perceive that goes into a task or an item, we often use the amount of effort we actually see as our shortcut to the perception of value. For example, when something takes little time or looks easy, or when the work itself is not visible, not transparent, a significant reaction occurs. An example is an attorney charging $500 an hour for work that's not transparent. Here's a simple example. If two people who live together are put in separate rooms and each asks the amount of housework the other does, the combined figure is almost always more than 100% because there's a transparency asymmetry. each is aware primarily of his or her own work, but unaware of the extent of the work of the other. We value and we perceive more accurately what is transparent. Another, projection bias. People believe that others hold the same beliefs and values that they do, and will into the future. An aspect of this that I see regularly is fan psychology. Fan psychology employs some innate projection bias, such as being a fan of a particular team or group by definition distorts thinking and creates bias. We identify with a player or a performer or an organization, and our thinking then influences our behaviors. This automatically frames how we view a call by a referee, for example, and we immediately lapse into all or nothing good or bad thinking. A projection of our belief or value onto another instantly creates a connection. Both projection bias as well as fan psychology are in part about belonging, of identifying with a group that shares beliefs and values. Another example I've seen when traveling to different parts of the world is how ethnocentric our own views in the United States are. So let's look now at bias remedies. A bias involves, as I mentioned, at times cherry-picking data to confirm our beliefs and specifically ignoring disconfirming data. Facts contrary to beliefs and self-images can be rapidly dismissed or just not engaged. A cue for a bias may exist without our awareness even, and which we may even consciously abhor. Mindset that one may not even be aware of would include race, gender, weight, socioeconomic. Now, think about how important that is, that we may have unconscious biases that we consciously would abhor because so many of those ways of seeing things have been ingrained without consciously modeling them throughout our lives and from very early on. Natural gravitation also occurs to others who share the same beliefs to engage in a kind of group think to further the notions and find affirming evidence. And group think can simply be shared blind spots. We work diligently to preserve our opinions even though we may not consciously know exactly what they are. The challenge, then, is to do three things initially. These are the first three steps of the ROADMAP system, the acronym of the system to deconstruct and understand a story, to look at the algorithms. The first three steps of the ROADMAP system, to recognize, own, and assess aspects of our own stories. The primary reason it's a challenge is new information can cause unpleasant feelings. New information may demand a change in beliefs. We tend to seek information that confirm our beliefs rather than disprove them. And new information may require us to take undesired actions. To leave the security of our known stories and the certainty and predictability of how they'll turn out can feel like a lack of control. Our default mode is not called a comfort zone for no reason, because to move away from it makes us uncomfortable. That's why any change, any new behavior, even desired and planned behavior, comfortable and confident are not prerequisites. They're places you get to, but you can't begin with comfort because, by definition, you began with discomfort because you move into doing something new. We're motivated to avoid new information. For example, people aren't afraid of going to the doctor. They're afraid their denial is going to be confronted. It may also be more difficult when the information is hard to understand or to interpret, like my very understandable aversion to certain technology. We first have to realize that we don't know. This is difficult because how do you come to know what you don't know? To know to ask is half the answer. Candid, open feedback from trusted others becomes one way. This is what we do in mentor coaching. In executive mentor coaching, I've also used a 360-degree assessment instrument to have someone self-assess, then get assessments on the same question on that person from a group of people who know that person quite well. This challenges the comfort zone, but provides objective and valuable information. Here's something I want to talk about as well, the hubris syndrome. While confidence is a state of mind that generates remarkable productivity, overconfidence can become a slayer of success. While our minds constantly learn from challenges, internally and externally, the creative and empathic process can be derailed by the complacency of power. It's been shown that the more we know and the better we become, the more likely we are to overestimate our own ability as well as underestimate the events beyond our control. In one study, CEOs became more confident as they gained merger and acquisition experience, resulting in their overvaluation of subsequent deals. In research from the University of Vienna, investors who obtained significant experience with their market then became overconfident, resulting in risky asset trades. Overconfidence and the brain's potentiation of stimulation enhances with sustained success and power. Blind certainty can replace active self-evaluation and self-reflection. Overconfidence increases with familiarity, repetition, information, and success. One of the best predictors of overconfidence is power, which enhances with time and experience and can result in the cessation of actually questioning alternate possibilities. Let's look for just a bit at talent. A fixed mindset sees talent as either present or non-present, something you're born with. A growth mindset recognizes that talent can be developed and enhanced through dedication and deliberate practice, something we've been talking about for 3+ seminars now. Edwin Moses, winner of 107 consecutive races and 4 world records, said, "I ran against a lot of individuals who were probably more physically talented." We now know from a number of perspectives that talent is not a genetic gift, but a developmental process. It can be enhanced when it's recognized, focused on, and nurtured by parents, teachers, coaches, mentors. Discipline and deliberate practice evolve both intellectual and physical talent. The social setting and enhancing framework contribute to both motivation and the maturation of talent. To recognize and advance sports talent in the socially prominent areas is easy. Baseball and basketball in the U.S., soccer in England, ice hockey in Canada. And sports make it easy because they're so visible, they're identifiable and measurable. Talent in other areas may not be as easily recognized, perhaps not as easily visible, not transparent. Talent in art, verbal ability, physical and mental skills become challenges to identify and facilitate. While there are different innate physical and mental capacities, just as individual personality and learning styles, The developmental process must be systematically nurtured by discipline and practice. Here's a compilation of a number of studies. An optimum model evolved from studies about the development of both expertise and talent is distilled to include these three aspects: early identification, sampling of a number of activities, especially early on, not specializing too quickly, and exposure for both informed choices and long-term involvement. Deliberate play, for example, of experiencing sport through fun and playful games becomes a solid foundation of intrinsic motivation. Deliberate play establishes a range of cognitive and motor experiences to develop both expertise and self-management, as well as a foundation of generalizable skills. Only later, experts suggest, perhaps by age 13 in most studies, should specialization occur, and only by late adolescence have children developed the physical, social, cognitive, emotional, and motor skills needed to specialize in just one sport or one endeavor, including intellectual. A composite of studies of elite performers across a number of fields has found these common traits that characterize their development and experience. And these are in your outline. These are the big eight: confidence, managing anxiety and pressure situations, mental toughness and resilience, the ability to focus and block distraction, hard work ethic, the practice of setting and achieving goals, being coachable, and optimism. These have all been the subtopics of some aspect of what we've been talking about now. A question: can there be a disadvantage of innate talent? The talent myth assumes a fixed mindset. Why spend time and energy trying to improve if success only comes to people with the right talent or the right genes? That skill and intelligence can be improved is a growth mindset. Talent can be a potential disadvantage, as someone with a natural talent early on may not, at the very beginning of skill development, subject himself or herself to the same hard work, rigors, and dedication as someone without those abilities. Natural talent can suffice for a period of time, but if it replaces the discipline and dedication to practice that needs to be developed, it can be a disadvantage. Those with less skills early on often have to work harder to develop them and may establish, this is key, a systematic way to grow and improve in this process. They may also develop repeated and related skills to supplement their achievement, such as knowing more about their opponent, engagement strategy, how to study other adaptations. Without relying totally on a natural athletic or intellectual capacity, they persevere through adversity to hone a foundation of repeatable strategies and skill development. So a shadow story of talent is that it can mask poor teaching or coaching for a significant period of time, or even until it's time to play a bigger game in some challenging way, intellectually or physically. So the question can become this: what does it take for really sustainable success? After their first unprecedentedly successful whirlwind tour of the United States, the first thing the Beatles did when they got back to England was go to the studio and make the next album. And they made a new album regularly every 6 months. They didn't bask in their glory or victory or let it derail their plans. They consolidated the success to integrate it with ongoing focus and plans. They pressed their advantage, but did not let success derail their plans or hijack their focus. Here's another application, an example. A client I'll call Evelyn consulted me because she was having burnout in her career. She had enjoyed remarkable and rapid success as an actress, moving quickly through local theater, national commercials, and a role ultimately in a nationally syndicated, very popular series. Her energy brightened a room. It induced optimism in others, and people were impressed with her imaginative and creative presence. Being highly intuitive and sensitive allowed her attunement and connection to others, as well as a total immersion in the character she played. With this sensitivity came the resonance with successful emotions from those around her, resulting at times in feeling emotionally drained, especially by crowds. She described her sensitivity to family and good friends, especially by fans who would approach her at restaurants and public places wanting her autograph or a selfie with her. She questioned whether the burnout meant that she was not suited for what she was doing, even though she really enjoyed the recognition and the stardom a great deal and seemed passionate about developing her craft. She had absolutely a growth mindset. We explored her state of mind around these experiences. She described how she had to go home because she would be depleted and would feel drained for hours. Even a nap wouldn't restore her energy. Her high degree of creativity and imagination was a natural for her expert work, but off the stage or the set, she didn't have the necessary buffers and boundaries to regulate her state of mind, resulting in significant depletion. She needed to develop an internal point of reference even more than most individuals, and her intuitive empathic style, at times selfless, was eroding the joy from her accomplishments, and her fame enhanced this even more. We focused on her desire to resonate with and nurture others that needed to be developed within herself first, to not abandon herself, to remain grounded in her own experience, specifically clear about and loyal to her own needs and ideals. She then developed a way to carve out her private space and a time devoted to her needs and have specific boundaries of her interface with others. All of this was aligned with her own ideals and then strategies and goals that fit with it. These pragmatic strategies allowed her to preserve her energy and to deploy it by conscious choice rather than in a reactive mode. For example, she developed an awareness of how the character she inhabited for a screen role was itself a state of mind and how to effectively enter and exit that state of mind each day so that she could preserve her own private space and not intermingle the two. Evelyn learned to dose time and titrate her exposure to others, to strategically plan her interface with crowds. At times, it simply involved reframing, saying no as a choice of self-care rather than feeling guilty or disappointing someone. She structured times each day for brief mindfulness meditation as part of that regulation and self-care. By more effectively grounding and centering herself and cultivating mindfulness, she developed a greater resilience to the influence and emotion of others. Her career soared even higher. So finally, I want to look at and contrast experts and amateurs. I'd like you to think about the application here. An expert and an amateur are each states of mind. The expert is an ideal, a contrast to the amateur. And I'm using these as metaphors, but also with a significant seriousness. Evolution from amateur to expert is a significant life-changing passage when it occurs. In fact, one of the simpler examples, and this would summarize all of what we've been talking about how to handle exceptional success. Coach Bum Phillips said to rookie running back Earl Campbell when he first came in the league, "When you get to the end zone, act like you've been there before." So some of the following distinctions can apply to that process of transformation from amateur to expert. Experts continue concentrated, deliberate practice on focused areas to develop with informed feedback. Amateurs get to a level of good enough and stay there. Experts seek practice and goals that exceed current levels of performance. Amateurs seek to sustain a comfort level without challenging it. Experts understand that there is no predetermined amount or limit of ability. Amateurs believe there is a fixed reserve of potential, talent or no talent. The expert works from love, passion, and dedication. Failure is information to guide proceeding. The amateur may be sidetracked by setback. Failure is validation not to proceed. The expert loves and pursues the game, whatever the game is, with total dedication and passion. The amateur proceeds and pursues it as a sideline, part-time, like a weekend warrior. The expert keeps going no matter what. The amateur is dissuaded by setback and adversity. The expert does what's important first. Amateurs do what's urgent first. An example, sometimes a football team can do more in the final 2 minutes of a half than in the previous 28, and not the Houston Texans, by the way, but with imminent clock and finite time remaining, can focus energy, attention, and concentration. The expert operates for the entire game in this zone. The amateur waits for the 2 minute warning. The expert is on a mission, knows that fear can never be overcome, and recognizes that the best indication of what's next may be also what generates the most fear. The expert knows that once action has begun, fear will recede like your lap when you get up to walk. The amateur must first overcome the fear, believing that comfortable is a prerequisite to begin. The expert knows that fairness is a childhood wish, that in adulthood there is not even an ultimate arbiter of fair. There's always adversity, unlevel fields, bad hops, rotten calls, injustice, unfairness. The amateur seeks fairness and is set back at what does not seem fair. The expert does whatever it takes, even what could never have been imagined. The amateur needs predictability, consistency, assuredness of results. The expert respects the craft but is not superior to it, recognizing the contribution of those who have gone before. The amateur believes in inherent luck, intelligence, and waits for inspiration to come. The expert dedicates to mastery. The amateur dedicates to proving himself or herself, needing to consistently demonstrate superiority and competence. The expert does not take things or people personally, recognizes that others always make self-statements, and does not succumb to criticism, envy, or idealization of others or by others. The amateur is subject to the perception of others, to rejection, and reads the responses of others as if looking into an accurate mirror of a valid reflection. The expert self-regulates and self-validates, takes in new information, but does not let it determine meaning. The amateur becomes an extension of the interest, desire, and needs of others, is vulnerably reliant on the perception and feedback of others. The expert has an internal point of reference, is proactive. The amateur has an external point of reference, is reactive. The expert seeks the mastery of art as work, deliberate practice as lifestyle, success as creation. The amateur believes that art is inspiration, talent is innate, and seeks the lucky break. The expert believes that the architect of magic is informed persistence and dedicated resilience. The amateur believes that magic is magic. The expert shows up every day no matter what, committed for the long haul. The expert understands delayed gratification, is the ant not the grasshopper, the tortoise not the hare. The amateur shows up as long as something else doesn't get in the way. The amateur looks for shortcuts, quick results, and immediate gratification. Experts know they can do best that which they do uniquely well. The amateur tries to do many things, to be everything to many people. The expert knows that the self and every storyline in life are created moment by moment, that the ultimate abandonment is of oneself. The amateur believes that much is predetermined, some fate, some circumstance, some luck, that consistent attention must be given to be appreciated and accepted by others. The expert believes that we write, live, and create in order to know. The amateur believes that we must know in order to write, live, and create. Experts add value to their art, science, expert body of knowledge, and to others. Amateurs add value to themselves. The expert believes that certainty develops with proceeding and mastery. The amateur must have certainty in order to proceed. The expert, even at times a warrior, believes in humility and modesty. The amateur believes in never showing vulnerability, doubt, or uncertainty. The expert punches through the bag, runs through the finish line. The amateur hits the front of the bag and relaxes at the finish line. And finally, the expert knows that courage is to proceed despite fear. The amateur believes that courage is the absence of fear. So the application of these principles of stress mastery and peak performance, I believe, can apply to all areas of business, education, arts, health, human relationships, sports. As we become more self-reflective and better learners, we more effectively write our own stories, whether those are life, career, wellness, relationship, money, or any other story. All are contributions to ourselves and to others simultaneously. So thank you for the opportunity to engage with you through these four seminars. It's been for me, a real creative pleasure putting these together for you and responding to some of your initial questions. I hope I've incorporated those answers and addressed them. I look forward to continued collaboration, hopefully, with each of you. I'm going to move to discussion mode now for anything that you'd like to actively discuss. Okay, we're in discussion mode. Thought, if you'll manage the background noise, thoughts, questions, anything that would be helpful for us to talk about?
Okay, I'm not going to come in because I'm at the airport, so I'm going to mute myself just now.
Okay, thanks. Anything you want to add or ask before you move? What about any thoughts or questions or areas?
Well,
clarify.
Just to say thank you, and the seminars have been quite rewarding.
Great. This is who?
This is Lilita.
Ah, great, Lilita. Thank you, and thank you for your input and interaction. I appreciate that and value that.
Thank you.
So you're welcome. What are the things you'd like additionally to talk about in with you? I'll take you up on your offer to mute for the background noise.
Yes, I did.
Call. Yeah, thanks.
That's okay. Good.
Thoughts, questions, anything that would be helpful to talk about? There are a couple of still hear some background noise. If you would mute, there are a couple of blogs. The most recent one on the boomerang effect that relate to some of the things we've talked about. There will be upcoming ones. One of the things I gladly defer to any questions. Otherwise, you're going to hear what I'm up to. So, final call. Questions, clarifications, anything? The one of the things I do is I spend a month at least each year, same time of the year in the early fall, in a very quiet part of the French Quarter in an old 200-year-old Creole house writing in the courtyard. When I was in medical school there, I would run in the quarter and see these gorgeous courtyards behind the wrought iron gates and wonder what it was like back there. Now I'm able to write in one. My writing retreat, so I do writing there, plus at my weekend ranch. One of the things I still, can I get a background noise mute?
I don't know if it's me. Better?
Better, yes. Okay.
Okay.
What I have begun, the two books. Good evening. My name is Desiree. I'm going to put us on lecture mode. Okay, I put us on lecture mode for the final couple of minutes, just to be sure that all of you hear this. This seminar series has evolved from what my most recent project is. You've seen on my email to you the two books that came out just in the last couple of months. They were the product of previous writing retreats there and other places. What I began last September is the NeuroMentor Peak Performance Institute, and this is the first that I'm offering this seminar series and a related webinar that you see on the home page of my of MentorPath and at the library that basically is the same title. What I will get to is a training for a licensed specialty certification for peak performance coaches, and I'm developing a curriculum, a client workbook, other material that would support coaches, and ultimately a book which would support the training. So that's what I'm up to, and I appreciate your early subscription to this, and I'll be very interested to hear feedback. I really value feedback as you look at the resources, the exercises, and material. Let me know what you think, what's helpful, what needs some more work. I rely heavily on feedback from colleagues and welcome it. So let me know how I can be of help to you. Give me feedback of anything that would be beneficial to you. And I really seriously mean I look forward to future collaboration. You have my email, and I hope to hear from you, and let me know if I can be of help to you in any way. Thank you all very much for your participation, your feedback, and the ongoing collaboration thus far. Thanks very, very much. To be continued.